In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Today's story is about stories. It's about how we tell them. It's about which stories survive, especially online. I'm not going to tell you much more than that to prepare you, but I want you to start by picturing an image you may have seen. You may have seen it in the link that you clicked on to get here, or you may have seen it just floating around the internet recently. It is honeycomb, but not normal patterned honeycomb. This one flows and curves and swoops, and it makes the shape of a heart. It's gorgeous. It really looks like somebody has spent time creating this. And according to almost anywhere that you will find this picture, it was the bees who spent all the time creating this, and they did it on their own when their beekeeper left the frame out of their hive. That's a lovely story. And we know it's lovely because it endures. Is it true? Is it mostly true or partly true? Is that by accident or on purpose? Is that for profit or for likes or for retweets? I don't know. The answer to those questions, though, are fascinating. And they're going to give us a look into an emerging form of study. Internet folklore. You see, when you're tweeting, when I'm tweeting, when we're sharing things, we're telling stories and writing down history. And you really can't predict what's going to stick around and how it will evolve. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Steve Byrne is based in Scotland. He is a traditional singer. He's also a folklorist, both traditional and internet. And we're going to talk about what that means. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Jordan. How are you?
I'm doing really well, thank you. And I am fascinated by the stuff you've been digging up about internet folklore specifically. But why don't we just start with, what does a folklorist do?
Well, what does a folklorist not do? I suppose in the Scottish context, what my main concern really is to do with, I suppose other language that people might understand more easily is folk ways, folk life. That's some of the language that certainly crept into folklore studies in the United States. In Scotland, for maybe the last 20, 30 years, we've talked a lot about a thing called ethnology, which is based on the European model of studying people's traditions and customs within their own immediate environments. But ethnology is a very difficult term for people to understand. I've famously got into taxis in Edinburgh, and where taxi drivers have asked me what I'm doing at the university, and Scottish ethnology was met with a few puzzled looks. Scottish technology, what's that? So,
right.
So we're trying to move, I suppose, more into helping people understand that they all have their own local traditions and local stories. And I suppose that that's what we would look at. In my town here in East Lothian, just outside Edinburgh, we're looking at the history of the working environment, as well as the local dialect and language, people's memories. So I suppose that's the kind of things that we're involved with. And a lot of this is done through actually collecting audio and video fieldwork.
And what kinds of time periods are you typically looking at when you do something like that around a locale?
I suppose it would be kind of biased a little towards the older generation. That's been a sort of typical feature of folklore study. And for obvious reasons, we're trying to get, you know, capture things that perhaps weren't able to be captured in days when we didn't have the modern technology that we have now at our fingertips. So I suppose living memory would be an aspect of that. However, there's a recognition as time has gone on that actually the everyday and the ordinary that's happening all around us is worth recording too. And that's really what we're trying to sort of inspire people in Scotland to think about, is to engage with their own local traditions and to realise that, you know, they have a story and a local story that's also worth you know, cataloguing and keeping a record of for future generations. So that's our take on it.
Can you give me an example or two of what that would look like when you're sort of trying to gather? Because again, when I hear folklore, I think, you know, generations past, as I'm sure most people do. But when you're gathering stories from the very recent past, what kinds of stories are they?
Yeah, I mean, folklore is a tricky term because certainly in the UK, folklore would be more towards myths and legends and castles, whereas we're trying to find language that is more meaningful to people to understand that it literally is the stories of local people. So I suppose here in the town, there was a big history of the cooperative movement in Tranent, in East Lothian, which is really marked in some of the landmarks in the town and the previous ownership and the history of the High Street. One of the things that's been happening here has been a town regeneration scheme. And as well as the regenerating the built fabric of the conservation area in the middle of the town, we've been collecting stories of people who worked in some of these shops, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And, you know, there's so much has changed in the advent of technology over the last, gosh, 10 years, never mind 60 years. So we're really looking quite literally at the way that people lived their lives and the way that people live their lives now.
And it's the advent of that technology and the kind of work you're doing with it now is why we're talking today. And yeah. I found a thread that you'd written on Twitter about a piece of internet folklore, which I'll let you get into detail about in just a minute. But first, explain, I guess, what internet folklore is in terms of how it's different from the kind of stories you just described.
I don't know that it's really that different. It's just a different mode. I suppose it was at one time felt that the internet wasn't really a place to find folklore. I suppose that was an attitude that existed in some quarters that maybe preferred more rural or mountain lore than that's found in urban settings. And I suppose it's partly to do with the concerns about outside influence, that somehow people felt that urban folklore would be more corrupted or, you know, the country folks would be more authentic or real. At one time there was some truth in that, but there's many examples of, you know, country folks singing songs to field collectors having got them from gramophone recordings, you know. So technology has actually mediated folklore for a long time. Even if you go back to thinking about things like the printing press, you know, traditional ballads would be eventually printed and would spread more widely. So the internet is just another medium, really, and one which, you know, lends itself quite well to this sort of thing, especially for kind of small, punchy platforms of, you know, local projects trying to get a place in the world. Alan Lomax, the American folklorist, often spoke about a thing called the global jukebox, where all cultures deserve their own fair share of the airwaves. And I think the internet has really democratized that in a way that traditional media hasn't.
So I guess I'm searching for a couple of examples of what, like, a true piece of internet folklore would be. And I feel like I want to say that we're talking about memes, but I don't think that's quite putting my finger on it.
You know, internet folklore, for, you know, it broadly is kind of looking at the way that things are interpreted and stories are shared. You know, certainly the website Snopes is something I referenced in the thread, is something that I became aware of in the 1990s, because you have to remember there was an early period on the internet where, you know, we didn't necessarily know, we didn't have our wits about us that this African prince who was emailing us with millions of dollars, you know, there was a time when that was a very new thing. So it's just looking back over the history of maybe the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years. And I was a student at university in the mid 90s when the internet and chat rooms and these kind of things were starting to take off and people were, you know, being duped and all of this kind of thing. So it's a rich field for a folklorist to look at how people interpret things and why they would interpret things like that. And one interesting thing about that is that, you know, many people nowadays, we think of the internet as being ubiquitous, but many people are coming to the internet quite late in their lives. And I can cite my, you know, my 72-year-old mum as an example. She's only had a tablet really for a couple of years. And she sees things on the internet that she thinks is, you know, is right. But, you know, I suppose we're into the territory of fake news as well, which is all quite superficial in its own way. But for folklorists, it's quite an intriguing way of viewing exactly how cultures and communities gather stories that then sort of propagate and change over time. And certainly that thread was one example.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.
So let's talk about it then. It's a thread, and we'll post the picture on all our social media accounts so people can look at it. But it's a picture, I guess, of a honeycomb shaped like a heart. Why don't you tell me where you found it and what you found out?
Well, it was just about the second week of June, and there was an artist had posted it. I can't remember. Somebody must have retweeted it in my feed. And they had said something along the lines that they're parents were beekeepers and that they had received this image from a fellow beekeeper in France. And my alarm bells kind of went off a little bit because I thought, well, I've seen this image before somewhere. I don't really know why. And then just reading through the thread, I started, you know, my folklorist brain started to kick in and say, gosh, people are interpreting this in so many different ways. It's a bit like traditional tales that are told that have existed for centuries, but actually they exist. You know, there's a Scots folk song called the Twa Sisters, the Two Sisters. It exists in Scandinavia, up in Iceland and parts of Central Europe. But the motif, and that's the thing, the motif in that particular story or that ballad changes a lot. There's one of them focuses on having a fiddle, and one of them focuses on having a harp and all this kind of thing. But the fundamental story is still the same. So I could start to see traces of that sort of mindset and that sort of propagation of a tale almost coming through the thread.
So when you started to get that feeling, what do you do next?
So I learned quite quickly to have a kit of tools, you know, a toolkit at my disposal to check things out, if you like. And obviously, lots of people still don't know that it's there, and the social media has changed that a lot. But it's obviously to do a reverse image search, which you can do with Google or you can do with TinEye, to actually see what is the provenance of this image on the internet. And other people were posting on the thread, citing the National Trust in England, which is a major heritage body, who had posted a version of this image on their Facebook page. And it seemed to indicate that it was the bees at one of their properties that they look after. But this just seemed to kind of not ring true to me. Originally I actually thought that the image was manipulated, you know, through Photoshop.
Right.
But it was kind of hard to pin that down. So yeah, a few more searches and looking for hints and tips, and what you often try and look for are things that repeat. That is back to the motif idea. So I kept finding examples of this image with the beekeeper forgot to put the frame in. And I just thought, gosh, this sounds like it's got a bit more to it, because that sort of phraseology had repeated several times, well, multiple times now through the web search on the reverse image search. And so it was clear to me it'd been around for a while. Wasn't quite clear for exactly how long. And then that set me on the trail of investigating this post on the National Trust Facebook site a bit more.
And so what did you find?
Well, there was a chap who had posted very matter-of-factly, oh, by the way, I made this. And his name was Brian Fanner. And people kind of didn't really take him at face value. They just said, haha, very funny. And I had started to post this back in the thread and say, look, this chap says he's done it. And I think there might be something to this. And people were like, nah, that you know, that's just trash and don't know what you're talking about, etc. So I sort of wielded my folklorist stripes and kind of went, well, speaking as a folklorist,
right.
there are a few things about this that make me think there's something else going on. So digging deeper, had found that Brian had put a few more kind of comments into this very long thread on the National Trust Facebook page, or the post was commented on and shared many thousands of times. And essentially, got to the point where I thought, I'm going to have to look into this guy a little bit more. And so I started raking around for Brian Fanner. And he mentioned at some point that I think he was in South Africa, and he put a post to his original, what he claimed was his original Facebook post in 2013. And it was a very modest post with not very many comments or likes. So you kind of think, well, that's a bit weird that that has gone viral from that point. And essentially, I just started to look into him, discovered that he actually was in South Africa. He was a beekeeper. There were articles about him in some environmental publications online. And gradually things started to fall into place. And so I suppose it's a bit of a detective hunt. But all the time, just remembering and you know, in the back of my mind, this idea that the story had obviously changed and propagated to end up being a supposed French beekeeper. And then if you keep looking around on the internet, you'll find people claiming it in other places as well. So I went on from there and posted on the thread on Facebook and asked the National Trust, and Brian Fanner had tagged them both, just saying, look, there's a bit of a Twitter storm going on. Any chance that you could shed some light on the origins of the image? And I should say, by this time, the original post by this artist and who had posted it, relating it to their parents, had something like 60,000 likes and 10,000 retweets. Mm-hmm. So it really grabbed a hold of people's attention. And the thing about it with the thread was people were fawning over it, going, oh, aren't bees so amazing? And this whole thing of, oh, Mother Nature is wonderful. And, oh, my goodness, how could such a thing happen? Which I can see from a mile off is people letting their, as I refer it to it, their awe gene kind of going haywire. Because, you know, what are the chances, really? So Brian gets in touch with me. My Facebook messenger pinged later on that night, and he sent me a picture of a bit of hardboard that he had routed out the design on, and then explained a lot more, which people can see on the thread, about how beekeepers use foundation strips that actually the bees latch onto and start constructing their honeycomb over the top of that in a regular hive. And normally that's just applied as a sheet rather than in a shape. So he'd obviously been trying to manipulate it. And it was just a very modest little story that Brian had done it for his wife as a little, you know, tribute, a lovely thing.
Right.
And from there on in, it seemed to have stuck around for another sort of 7 years or so, and by which time it had been through several iterations and had really taken on the mantle of internet folklore, to be honest.
Why, though?
I suppose because of the way that the story seems to have been told and change. And there are these, I mean, I guess we're really back to memes in a sense, but there are these ways that people believe things for certain sort of preconceived reasons, which is to do with their sort of their own situation and their community and their attitudes towards receiving and interpreting stories that kind of fit with their own identity. And I suppose one of them, and this is moving in a slightly more sinister direction, that sticks in my mind, that is also, to my mind, a version of internet folklore, is you've probably seen at one point a meme going around where people are talking about what the pension payments are for older citizens, usually claiming it to be in their country, and then comparing that to what either refugees or illegal immigrants supposedly receive in comparison. This is actually a really old meme. I mean, it's been around for at least 10 years, and it got so bad at one stage that the UK Parliament actually, on their website, you know, the Parliament Library, issued a rebuttal, because its own investigation showed that this had been around since the mid-2000s, probably originating in Australia or Canada, you know, where people adapt and change a few words. But as a folklorist, you always look back for this kind of, this part of the story that seems to stay fairly similar, and or the wording that seems unusual that makes you think that doesn't ring true to this particular community and how they would normally express themselves.
Can you intentionally shape any of this folklore, or is it just kind of happenstance?
I think there's an argument to be made, and I suppose we've carried it out in a professional setting for what we would term interventionist folklore, and that is really about. One of the things in Scotland, certainly, is that folklore studies and archive material has stayed in the academy and in academic settings for a very long time. and has not really been in the public sphere. And the internet project I was involved with was about digitizing reel-to-reel recordings from a major sound archive at the University of Edinburgh. And in 2010, thereabouts, a huge chunk of that went online for the first time. So instead of having to either be a student or an academic in a department that didn't want to lend out its fragile reel-to-reel tapes because repeated playing basically damages them, then people were actually able to access and hear a different version, I suppose, of history and their local history that hadn't really been to the fore before. So what we then did after that was take some of the recordings back to the towns in which they were first collected. And in my case, that was back to my hometown of Arbroath on the East Coast. And we took songs that we found from a woman in the town that was singing about one of the local mills and some ways of life to do with farming in the area. And we took it back and taught it to many kids in some of the schools. And there's something like maybe 400 or 500 kids over the last, 7 years, maybe learned some of those songs in my hometown. And there would be ethical queries about that from some more traditional folklorists. But I think the time has passed where it used to be a sort of more anthropological outsider view of folklore, where people would study it from afar. There's much more of an insider study your own culture as a sort of, person on the inside who understands the way that a community works.
You mentioned, especially on the internet, this is an emerging field.
Yeah.
What does it look like 10 years from now?
Yeah, that's quite a question. I think we're at a really interesting point, and maybe a difficult point, I would say, where I've certainly noticed over the last year or so, the real growth, especially amongst the fake news aspect, where people just post things without checking, willy-nilly. And that was the ultimate heart of my long thread on Twitter, was to really look behind what you see online, because, you know, people can actually use this for nefarious reasons. So it's really worth checking and putting a bit of common sense across it. Unfortunately, not everybody is blessed with a great deal of common sense sometimes, and that includes some family members of mine. But I guess we're just trying to sort of, I suppose, lead the charge a little bit for people just to be a bit more discerning, mostly in the interests of folk being kinder to each other, I think, because, things being misunderstood on the internet, it's not necessarily new. It's just the speed at which that can happen has changed massively in the 20th century. You know, from a newspaper headline that takes a few days or a week or two to propagate, it can literally be around the world within a day. So I think we have to be careful about the technology that's there. And really, from the point of view of folklorists and people working in community settings, just try and do our best to help people to equip themselves with the tools to work with this stuff.
Do you think we'll ever see consensus about anything ever again, considering the way the internet decentralizes everything?
I don't think consensus is necessarily helpful. I mean, we talk about diversity and tradition as well, and that's the thing. In nature as well, diversity is a strength. And one of the interesting things for me as a Scottish folklorist is that for a long time, you kind of get into the mindset of a kind of homeland view of it, where this is a Scottish thing or this is a particularly regional thing. But actually, some time spent in the United States really brought home to me that in the States, they've had to develop a universal theory of folklore because of the many migrant communities that kind of live cheek by jowl. That ultimately folklore is of people and not necessarily, you know, any worse or better for being from different communities. And I think that's informed my view a lot more in terms of viewing the way that things work in Scottish communities. And we talk more about folklore and traditional culture in Scotland rather than of Scotland, because we think that's more inclusive of the migrant communities that live here, what we call New Scots. So I think diversity of stories and experience is useful, but I think people should be wary of diversity of opinion for opinion's sake at the expense of facts.
Steve, thank you for this fascinating discussion today. Stuff you do so interesting.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Steve Byrne joining us from Scotland, where he finds stories, tells stories, studies stories. That was The Big Story. I hope you enjoyed our break from the crushing news cycle. If you'd like more, you can find them at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find us on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn. You can write to us and suggest other weird topics because we love them. The email address is thebigstorypodcast, that's all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. This episode of The Big Story was produced by Joseph Fish. Claire Brassard and Stephanie Phillips and Ryan Clark will be back before you know it. In fact, tomorrow. I won't be back tomorrow, though. Steph will be filling in. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Steph will talk to you tomorrow.